And our special guest tonight, Bruce Maccabee. We're going to talk about Nikola Tesla when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM, the Death Ray. Well, for those of us, Bruce, who love the Tesla stories, nothing captures our imagination more than the possibility of his death ray or his beam weapon. How did you get interested in Tesla?
Well,
How's the cold,
my
reason, you okay?
What?
How's the cold? You okay?
I'm hanging in there.
Okay, my man.
My recent interest, I guess, was generated about 7 years ago when I was on Bob Hieronymus's radio show in Baltimore, 21st mm-hmm. Century Radio, and after I was on talking about UFOs and stuff, he let me rummage around in his free bookstore, you might say, for people who are on his show. He gives away copies that booksellers, you know, send them for a review and stuff.
Sure.
So anyway, I was rummaging through, and I see this book by a guy named Mark Seifer on Tesla, and I said to myself, well, you know, I've heard about him a lot. Oh, especially some pretty strange stuff in recent years. But more than that, I sort of had a feeling of a connection with Tesla that goes back to my father in the 1950s when I was in high school. We were in a radio club, and one of the things he wanted to do with the radio club was actually have him build a Tesla coil, not a tiny one, but one that was about 2 to 2.5 feet in diameter and 4 feet high.
That's big.
And so... sure enough, he figured out how to build this thing. He was a radio engineer, had built his first radio back in the 1920s. He was working on radar in the Second World War, so he knew how to do this. We built a 600-turn secondary, space-wound at the top. A primary was, I think, 10 or 11 turns, a very heavy wire on a framework that slanted outward. So the top turn was larger in diameter than the smallest turn. At the very bottom of the coil. This is to avoid arcing. And we drove it with a 15,000-volt sine transformer that drove a carbon arc and tuned circuit capacitor to tune the primary. So a Tesla coil is unique. It's a resonant transformer situation. And the output voltage you get is bigger than just the ratio of the turns. And I can remember this thing in the basement of my house causing the pipes to light up. And you could draw big sparks off it, you know. I wouldn't draw it straight to my finger, but I could hold a nail in my hand and draw a spark about a foot long.
God.
Yeah, this was it wasn't a super big one, of course, but it was potent. I was always afraid to turn it on because I was always afraid there'd be some truck driving by with a radio direction finder on it looking for the source of interference with everybody's radio and TV for some hundreds of feet or miles around. I never knew exactly what was going to happen. I didn't dare ask anybody, oh, by the way, did your TV suddenly go awry?
Yeah, exactly.
For a period of time last night. But anyway, point is that my father told me about Tesla and how he got essentially screwed by Westinghouse. The story there is that Tesla had invented this polyphase motor, signed the patent over to Westinghouse way back in the late 1890s, and Westinghouse was building these things and started to complain that his company didn't have enough money to be able to pay Tesla what the contract actually specified, which was some amount of money per horsepower that they were selling. And so Tesla tore up the contract. Under the assumption, I guess, that Westinghouse would take care of him in other ways.
He really trusted them.
Yeah, right, he did, which was not a good thing to do. No. Marconi didn't trust him. He made sure that he got his money whenever there was money available. But anyway, that's how when I saw this book at Bob Hieronymus's place, I... said, oh, well, okay, here's a book about Tesla. I'll take this. And I read it, and halfway through the book, where we're getting to the point on the Wardenclyffe plant and so on about how he's going to transmit power through the atmosphere and how J.P. Morgan was funding this at the time, and how the decision came down to something as crude, mundane, what do you want to say, as, well, right now we've got Tesla's polyphase system that's carried by wires. We've cranked up mines and forests to the point where we can create tons of hundreds of miles of copper wire and zillions of telephone poles, and we'll make lots of money doing this. And if we allow Tesla to build something that doesn't need wires and telephone poles, we'll lose a lot of money.
We're dead.
So therefore, exactly. Screw Tesla.
Yep, it was all about the money.
I said to myself, wait a minute. People should know this, right? Here's a major decision on the part of industrialists that's based on making bucks. And, we don't know whether Tesla could have been successful or not. Probably not, I would say, based on what we know now. But in any event, at the time, what Tesla was doing looked good. And simultaneously, or about the same time after I read this book, I was talking to some people out in Los Angeles, Tracy Torme and some other guys.
Oh, sure.
They're saying, we sure wish we could make a movie about Tesla, but nobody's been able to come up with something. So I sort of took this as a hint. They indicated that, we'd be interested if you could come up with some sort of a good script. So I sat down and I wrote this thing, which is on my website. You can click on read this. It's sort of a novel in the format of a stage play, movie. So there's more than you couldn't do this on stage, but you could do it as a movie.
Is it the life of Tesla, or does it have some
This has got high drama, because I call it a novel. It's based on the life of Tesla. You do learn about the life of Tesla in it. This is a novel because it tackles the problem: what would have happened, or might have happened, had Hitler's spies decided to steal Tesla's weapon. And this is not a zero probability thing. Tesla had gone public in the 1930s saying that he could create a defensive weapon that would shoot down airplanes at a distance of 200 miles.
Any range at that 200-mile rate. I mean, if there were 60 planes in the sky.
10,000 airplanes an hour or something like that.
He'd take them all down. Yeah, okay.
Right. Well, now, in the actual World War II, not long after, in the 1941-42 time frame, Hitler, of course, was flying there. The Luftwaffe had a lot of aircraft, but they were being shot down faster than they could be built and replaced. So I conceive of an idea that what if Hitler's henchmen had decided that maybe we could use Tesla's weapon to help defend Germany itself? And so in this script, if you read the script, you'll see I have a beginning with walking into Hitler's bunker and watching him talk with a couple of people, German officers, who have conceived of this plan to get Tesla's secret weapon, which they believe is in a hotel. I forget the name of the hotel now. Supposedly Tesla had left a box for safekeeping and as collateral against his rent. By the time he was in the 1930s, Tesla was basically a poor man. Yeah. Although he had made billions, well, I don't know about billions, but certainly tens or hundreds of millions of dollars for other people, he was just barely scraping along.
What a shame.
Yes. The action in this takes place on the day, most of the action takes place on the day before Tesla was found dead. And during this time, I've managed to conceive of a story where his life is reviewed in the movie by a scientist who has to make a decision as to whether or not this weapon could be real.
Well, when are we going to make this? When are we going to make this movie?
Well, as soon as somebody comes up with 30, 40, 50 million bucks. Even if you didn't make the whole thing, if you made pieces of it, you read the script, there's a bunch of chunks in here on his life. For example, his display, his presentation at the Chicago World's Fair, the Columbian Exhibition in 1893, or any one of his demonstrations at his own laboratory. You have people like Rudyard Kipling and Mark Twain, Sarah Bernhardt, all these people who were famous at the time. Paderewski, people who were buddy buddies with Tesla because he hobnobbed with the top of society.
Well, he was a genius. I put him in the category of the Albert Einsteins, Bruce.
Right, and where Einstein was more
theoretical,
thinking about stuff. Obviously, Tesla could think too, but he was in there with his bare hands wiring, making all these coils and stuff.
Well, let's talk about the reality of this beam weapon, this death ray. How far in reality did he go with this? Because I've got to ask you about this explosion that occurred in the early 1900s over Siberia,
you're
Tunguska.
About the Tunguska meteor.
Absolutely. Because some people think it might have been a Tesla ray, but tell us about the beam weapon.
Well, I don't think that Tesla had anything to do with that.
You're about Tunguska.
The beam weapon, had it been developed, would have been in the 1930s, based on what he discovered in 1899 when he was at his laboratory in Colorado. And this stuff is all portrayed in the script that I wrote. His life is portrayed in a scene as a little kid, 13-year-old, building a water wheel, and his friends help him break it for him. But nevertheless, in this first scene is about his life. He looks at the picture of Niagara Falls at his uncle's house, and he says to his uncle, I'm gonna make that waterfall generate power. Now, he's 13 years old when he says this.
True story?
Something like 20 years later when he did it.
Okay.
I have a series of things that, are basically speculation on this beam weapon, because he never really published all the details of it.
All right, so it was really never built, right?
Well, we don't know. In the script, I have it actually a model built, and the scientist who was trying to decide whether or not it could be real comes upon that in this biography of Tesla, which I've sort of invented a biography, and concludes that the thing is real and the German spies might be getting it. Well, I won't tell you the climax of the move of the script. But they do actually get a hold of this thing in the script, and for a particular reason, the whole history of the world didn't change at that point.
Okay, but let me. But
it might have changed had Hitler been able to put up a defensive weapon that would have shot down our aircraft faster than we could build them.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. But let's go back down to reality, though. So we really don't know, though, if Tesla ever built the beam weapon or not.
That's I'd say that's probably right. Although there might have been some sort of a model or pieces of it which he could imagine being put together to build such a thing. But certainly a full-size version was never built.
How big was
it? Whether it was a model or not, I don't know.
How big was it supposed to be had he constructed it?
Well, it would have been, 50, 100 feet, some sort of a tall structure roughly similar to the Wardenclyffe system.
Okay, so it would have been huge.
It would have been huge, and there would have been a bunch of them along the coast in order to shoot down. If we were going to do it to protect our own coast, you'd have to have a bunch of them along the coast to provide the defense. So it wouldn't have been a trivial matter, that's for sure.
Is this the same as electromagnetic pulses, or is this energy that he's merely grabbing from the
he talked about tiny particles being accelerated and shooting outwards. Now, he invented what we nowadays call the aero window, where you can go from a low pressure area near vacuum to atmospheric pressure, if I recall correctly. And this may have been part of his weapon to basically build a particle accelerator and then shoot these particles out into the atmosphere. Now, I've read some theories that he was going to use a optical beam guided plasma discharge, something that's being worked on even as we speak. People are using ultraviolet light from a laser to ionize a channel, create a line of ions in the atmosphere, and then follow this with a very high voltage discharge. This is a taser. You could if you did this with a, you know, made a taser that didn't have wires but actually had two parallel ultraviolet beams, and then a high voltage arc device that sent ions down the beams. That would be sort of like what I'm talking about, but on a much larger scale.
Okay. Now, is it true that when Tesla died, that all his plans were stolen or confiscated?
No, not as I understand it. Again, this, you can find this in a number of books. And by the way, the FBI has a file on this stuff, so a lot, some of which is still blacked out for some reason or other.
Right.
But the FBI file goes right back to the day after he died. The FBI got involved immediately, along with the alien. I forget the name of the agency, a government agency that worried about people who weren't native to the United States. In any event, the government essentially bottled up his papers, confiscated them, and then a couple of years later released them to a relative who put them in the museum in Belgrade.
Does that include the death ray papers?
I suppose it includes everything. They had somebody go through all this stuff and try to find out whether there was any golden nuggets of information that should be known.
Course, I would guess, Bruce, that they've kept the good stuff.
Well, that may be. Certainly, he started a lot of areas of research and was far ahead. Like in almost every generation, the real geniuses are so far ahead of everybody else that it's hard to make a connection between them, between what they're doing and what the average population is doing. You can read articles about people who went to his laboratory to see demonstrations of stuff that was absolutely, as far as they were concerned, was like magic. They could not figure out how it was happening.
Oh, yeah, he was years ahead of himself.
Right.
Years ahead of himself. As a matter of fact, when we come back after the break, there are some people who believe that there was some kind of Tesla UFO connection. Have you stumbled into that?
Yeah, I've stumbled into it, and there are people who believe he probably came from another time or another planet, another universe.
Oh, really?
I suppose. I doubt that. I mean, you can trace his life back to the beginning, and it seems to be a normal birth, shall we say.
Tesla was a time traveler.
Yeah, right.
That's kind of funny because
there's a book called A Man Out of Time. See, by Cheney, what's her name? Margaret Cheney wrote a book called Tesla, Man Out of Time.
Now, that is strange. That's a strange theory. You know, we've been covering a story about a guy who claimed to have been a time traveler who's gone now, came from the year 2036, named John Teeter. That's kind of interesting. Tesla, Teeter, I wonder if they're one and the same. You never know anymore.
Well, I don't know if Mr. Teeter made any big technological breakthroughs while he was here.
Yeah, he mentioned some interesting things on a website that he was posting, but he talked primarily about the things that would happen within this country, civil war and everything else. And you know what? Just on basis of what I saw over the last couple days, the old guy might have been right about some things.
People marching in the streets.
Yeah, absolutely. But the mind of Tesla, absolutely fascinating. And I want to talk with you a little bit more about that. I don't think he was an abductee. Do you?
Nope.
No. Just a human being who just had a brain, I guess.
He had a brain capable of creating three-dimensional pictures in his brain, and I have this in the script. His first, when he essentially invented the rotating magnetic field, which the polyphase, which drives the polyphase motor, the breakthrough device which made electrical power transmission worthwhile. And you can imagine how this actually happened. As is written in the script of this play, my conception of what actually happened.
And Tesla, of course, did claim that he received some signals from another world. Let's talk about that when we come back. Well, the After Dark newsletter, the April issue, highlights none other than Alex Jones. If you're interested in that, well, all you simply have to do is call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Interesting programs coming up for you, by the way, this weekend. Don't forget Ian Punnett's program, 6 p.m. Pacific time to 10 p.m. That's the Coast to Coast live show. I'm filling in for Art on Sunday. And my guest will be Lou Gentile. Lou is his own talk show host in his own right, and he's an expert on demonology and some other issues.
I'm looking forward to chatting with Lou about that. And 2 months ago, when I was interviewing Las Vegas reporter, investigative reporter George Knapp, I had mentioned to George, you know what, I would like you to host a program when somebody goes on vacation, because George was one of those who investigated and reported for many years about Area 51, interviewing Robert Lazar, Bob Lazar. So George will do this Saturday's Coast to Coast program, interviewing guests Gene Huff and Bob Lazar about Area 51. So that'll be a pretty good story based on an incredible event. So stick with us all weekend long. We'll be back in a moment as we continue with Bruce McAbee next hour. If Bruce's voice holds up and he battles the cold, we'll keep him around for phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Bruce, let's talk about what Tesla's claim was, and tell me about this story, that he received signals from another world. I'm not familiar with that one.
While he was doing his experiments at Colorado Springs in 1899, in the summer of 1899, where he discovered that the Earth is a big capacitor, essentially, he had very sensitive devices for picking up radiated signals, we would consider it now low frequencies. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, anything above a few hundred hertz was a high frequency.
That's true.
What we would now consider low frequencies. But in any case, he had sensitive devices for picking up any radiation that might be coming in. And he, in fact, was able to listen to thunderstorms, he said, at a distance, I think, 500 miles up or something like that. So one time, one night while he's doing these experiments, he gets a series of signals or a repetitive, repeated series of three pulses, I guess you could say, of radiation.
Or bursts or whatever.
Beep, 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 something like that. Now, as far as he was concerned, he was the only person on Earth who had what you could consider to be a sensitive radio receiver. This was before vacuum tubes had been the radio vacuum tube had been invented by Lee DeForest in around 1910 or something like that. The detection was of electromagnetic signals was difficult. In any event, he had a sensitive detector, and as I said, he believed he was the only person who had both a radio frequency transmitter and receiver on the Earth. Now, he then interpreted this as being potentially a signal from off the Earth. The counter argument to that has been that Marconi was testing himself. He himself was testing the transmission of radiation.
Ah, and he might have picked that up.
And that's right. So far as I know, no one has ever established that Marconi was in fact sending the letter S, which is three dots is the telegraphic Morse code for S. Did it, it, da, 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 did it, it, became famous in the First World War for SOS.
yeah, you're right.
It's conceivable that he received something that Marconi was sending. I don't know whether Marconi would have been sending this in the vicinity of New York City or in England at the time. If that were true, then he was receiving Marconi signals over a distance of a few thousand miles, which is phenomenal. But I have to say that long-distance transmission is not unheard of. My father told me how he built his first radio, which had a one-tube radio. The coils that were the tuning devices were wound on oatmeal boxes. He was able to sit there in Rutland, Vermont, and listen to a radio station in California. That was back in the days before there were so many radio stations that they cluttered the dial up with interference. So that's just an example of the long-distance transmission. I mean, thousands of miles can occur, even at low frequencies.
You know, you've hit it perfectly. I hope you can get your movie up there on the big screen, or at least in the DVD arena, because I'd love to see the speculation on what could have happened had Tesla lived, or had his death machine been taken away. Now, what's going on? Obviously, if he was way ahead of his times, Bruce, some scientists today has now began to look at some of the things he thought about and has been trying to convert that to today's technology. It's got to be a black ops program. It's very secret. But do you think we're working on that, that we may have duplicated what Tesla wanted to do many years ago?
Well, like I said, even today, there's research on this idea of being able to send a plasma beam along a channel created by a laser beam. Now, of course, Tesla didn't have laser beams to work with. There's some evidence, I guess, that he was thinking of using a light beam to create an ion path. But more than that, I think he basically was presaging what you might call atom smasher or particle accelerator type of thing.
Which is what they've got now at CERN in Switzerland.
Well,
they've had
particle accelerators since the 1930s, a cyclotron device. That was invented by a guy by the name of E.O. Lawrence, whose name is Lawrence Livermore, the Lawrence of Lawrence Livermore Labs in Berkeley, California. Anyway, the idea of accelerating particles in a straight line and then zapping them out into the atmosphere is apparently something like what Tesla was talking about. He talked about having four in the late 30s or earlier, or 1940, there was an article in the New York Times where he talked about having four major breakthroughs, two of which had been tested. He didn't say which two had been tested. But he was talking about a beam that had a diameter much smaller than a millimeter. And if this is true, then he would be talking about some sort of thing like a particle beam.
Oh, absolutely. Do you believe HARP, and you know what HARP is up there in Alaska, HARP may be based on Tesla technology at all?
Well, to the extent that almost everything that has to do with radio is based on Tesla technology one way or another, I would say yes, but I don't think it's a beam weapon or something. At the time that Tesla was working in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people weren't aware of the properties of the so-called F layers in the upper atmosphere that reflect radio waves back down and so on. The HARP device has been accused of heating the atmosphere. Well, it does heat the atmosphere to some extent, where the atmosphere is extremely rare. A very thin atmosphere up at high altitude. It doesn't, compared to the heating of the sun and so on, this is a fly bugging an elephant, I guess.
What about weather manipulation, Bruce? I mean, is that conceivable? You know, we've had a number of guests who actually believe hurricanes are being created and pushed and moved. Did Tesla ever do anything about that, about weather?
Not that I recall. I can't say that he didn't do anything, because he did so much. You have to know just about every minute of every day of his life to know what he did and what he didn't do. As far as modifying weather is concerned, I doubt it. He got into all sorts of things, like electrical fertilizer. He came up with a way of increasing nitrogen in the grain and earth using electromagnetic or electric currents.
Just sending currents right into the ground?
Well, you had to have some special additive to the soil, and then you managed to take the idea is that you want to get nitrogen fixed in the soil. And this is done by natural biological means, but it could be done much faster and more efficiently if you could do it electrically. And he came up with some way of doing it. I don't know why it hasn't been followed. There may be some other reasons, but in any case, that's just an example of the things that he got into that seemed to be way out of the character of the typical stuff he worked on.
What a mind. What a mind he had. Shame that we lost him. You think he died of how did he die? I mean, was there any...
Well, he was living a very sparse existence in a hotel in New York, or I think it was, in New York. And you know, in his last days, he was essentially treated like a gentlemanly old nut. He was feeding pigeons all the time. He had pigeons flying around his hotel room.
Howard, he became a Howard Hughes.
Basically, he was just found by a hotel employee, as I recall, on the 8th of January, 1943.
And how old was he when he died?
80-something, rather.
Ah, okay. Well, he lived a long life. That's a pretty good shot. Well, what a shame. He died penniless, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. He was essentially a pauper, I'd say, for the last 10 years of his life.
Did he have family? Did he have any offspring? Was he ever married?
No.
So there are no Teslas running around.
There are no Teslas running around. I suppose you could write a book called Tesla in the 21st century involving a clone of Tesla or something.
Holy blood, holy Tesla or all something right. like that. Well, now, in addition to all the things you've done, tell me a little bit about what you do in the music world.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've played the piano and the pipe organ a lot longer than I've been doing UFOs. I started when I was 5 years old, and my mother teaching me, and I didn't do very well at that point. So when I was seven, she started me with a real teacher. And I took lessons all the way through high school. At the same time, when I was about 14, I started learning how to play a pipe organ. And
so you can play that chamber music?
And I can play chamber music, or I can play...
Phantom of the Opera.
Small music or big music. Yeah, I've done pieces out of the Phantom of the Opera. I play for two churches right now, as a matter of fact, every Sunday. And I have played in bands and solo stuff, classical and popular and rock and roll and so on. There's some stuff on my website you can listen to. One of the pieces that's there, I call The Flight of the Bumble Boogie, which starts off with The Flight of the Bumblebee played straight through, but in a unique way, accompanied by my son on drums and my younger daughter on playing the bass. I don't think The Flight of the Bumblebee has ever been done that way. And then it goes right, segues right into what's called the Bumble Boogie that was popular back in the 50s. Again, with the drums and the bass in the background.
Do you think having that music appreciation helped you at all in any of the work you've done? Did it tune you up?
I don't know. I wrote a piece for this Tesla play. A piece I call I'll Never Forget, which is a testament, intended to be a testament to the recalling Tesla, you might say. It doesn't have any words on it. I don't consider myself a lyricist, but I suppose somebody could write some. At any rate, it's hard to say. I wouldn't say that music has had any direct impact on my UFO research, but music and science often go together in a person.
Bruce, as your UFO
Tesla,
research...
Tesla, by the way, was an avid fan of music.
Well, has your UFO research hindered you at all in your career? I mean, if people looked at you with a different eye?
I suppose in some cases it hasn't affected my career, so far as I can tell, because I, believe it or not, I try to keep a low profile.
I mean, PhD in physics.
Being on your show is not exactly a low profile.
No,
but
not at all.
I've had transient events that have been even a higher profile than that. After I investigated the famous New Zealand sightings of December 1978, I was on Good Morning America in March of 1979, and where I work at the Naval, what I was working then at the Naval Surface Weapons Center. In Silver Spring, Maryland, where I was working, the editor of the laboratory newspaper saw me on TV and thought, wow, what a great story to write about. So she made me the centerfold of the next issue of the paper, talking about me investigating the New Zealand case. And the total response she got to that was, the captain in charge of the laboratory complimented her on the format of the paper, the high quality issue. And that was it. One guy contacted me and told me his sighting. That was a total response. I had been told, essentially, by the higher-ups that they didn't care what I did in my spare time as long as they didn't bring them into it officially.
Right. So, well, that was good of them.
That's basically been it. And I've managed to thread the needle. I hear about other people who have done things running into resistance one way or another, but I've been fortunate.
Did you ever meet the late Dr. Hynek in your travels?
Oh, yeah.
Your work?
He stayed at my house one time.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yep. No, I'm not kidding. I met him a number of times at conferences. The first time, I guess, probably in the early 70s, I spoke at a conference in Chicago in 1976, the first conference of the Center for UFO Studies. In 1980, there was a UFO symposium at the Smithsonian Institution. I think that's when it was that he stayed at my house one night. He and I sort of were talking about stuff, you know, and the question came up, how do you manage to live knowing all this stuff? And the answer was, I live every day as if it weren't real.
That is an interesting statement. He changed when he was heading up Project Blue Book for the Air Force.
He did not head up Project Blue Book. He was the scientific consultant. He was a nearby astronomer who was willing to take it on in 1948.
Okay, for so Project
Blue
Book.
He was hired by Project Sign, continued through the so-called Project Grudge, and when Project Blue Book officially began in the spring of 52, he was continued as the as scientific consultant.
I see. Okay. Okay.
And yes, he was essentially a debunker all the way through the 1960s, although he was sufficiently honest, unlike apparently the some of the military guys who happily spewed out explanations. Hynek was sufficiently honest to admit that some of the things seemed to be puzzling. And the first case that he really ran into that really bugged him was the Lonnie Zamora police officer case of Socorro, New Mexico, in I think it's April of 1964. And they were never able to break Socorro Zamora's story. And at that point, I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back, you might say, and Hynek began to change his tune. He criticized Project Blue Book at the time of the Condon study at the University of Colorado, which took place in 67, 68.
Oh, yeah, that was a whitewash. That was horrible.
But Hynek was saying that he was criticizing Blue Book by that point. And then after the Air Force closed Project Blue Book in 1969, Hynek announced that he was going to start his own center. There's no longer an official collection agency for reports. Of course, there were a couple of major civilian organizations,
sure.
One called NICAP, National Investigating Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and the other one called APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization,
right.
And then there were smaller ones.
Yeah, but and both of those eventually
time, also,
went.
The Mutual UFO Network was founded in the late 60s, too. So all those were available after Project Blue Book ended. But Hynek decided to found his own center anyway, which he did in 1972, I think it was. And he wrote a book that came out in 1973, in which he outlined the UFO situation. And his most famous part of that book is that he coined the phrase "Close Encounters of the Third Kind."
Exactly. And I'll always remember him with his pipe, Bruce, in the movie "Close Encounters of the Third Kind." Stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines as long as Bruce's voice continues to hold on. He's got a cold, but we'll take your phone calls on UFOs, investigations, and also Tesla. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.